Welcome to the Pursuit of Learning podcast. I'm your host, Clint Murphy. My goal is for each of us to grow personally, professionally, and financially, one conversation at a time. To do that, we will have conversations with subject matter experts across a variety of modalities. My job as your host will be to dig out those golden nuggets of wisdom that will facilitate our growth. Join me on this pursuit. Finding meaning in our work, finding meaning in our lives. These are things most of us want. Many of us, though, are climbing the wrong mountain. Scott Shu, author of The Full Body Yes, shares how we can change our work and lives from the inside out. The power is inside all of us. I hope you enjoy the show. Scott, welcome to the Pursuit of Learning. Can we start our conversation with what's motivating you in life right now? And what are two or three things that you want to get across to our listeners in today's conversation?
Sure. Wow. Well, what's motivating me, I guess, in the big picture is, you know, my mission in life is to change work from the inside out in two ways. One, by mainstreaming mindfulness, and two, by operationalizing compassion. And this seems to be my, you know, kind of my purpose in life, and the two flavors of my life, my career and my personal interests, all kind of bound into one. And a few things to get across in our discussion is that, you know, how we balance our ambition with our inner peace. This is the question I get asked a lot. Like, how do I be a good person? How do I get things done? How do I be successful at work? And how do I be compassionate? How do I be at peace? How do I achieve whatever, a state of enlightenment? So that feels like big enough territory. There's lots of things under there to talk about.
Yeah, and I know we're going to get into all of those based on our conversation on your book, Full Body Yes. So why don't we start with, what was your motivation? Well, you somewhat answered that right now. Your motivation when you wrote the book, correct me if I'm wrong, was to change work from the inside out and spread the message of compassion and mindfulness in the workplace.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for me, it was a compulsion, I guess you could say. Like, it was a mission. I was with my friend. My friend Soren and I were coming back from an event that we were doing together. And he was driving. I was in the passenger seat. And he gets this funny look. He looks over at me and he goes, "The universe has told me to tell you it's time to write your book." And we both laughed and laughed. And then I kind of checked inwardly. I'm like, yeah, it does feel like time. You know, because I'd been thinking about writing a book for 30 years or more than that. So I was 15 years old. And it was finally time. Yeah. Just at that point in my life where it was ripe, you know, like a fruit.
And the interesting part is you talk about the fact that you see these messages often in life when you're willing to slow down and zone in on what's happening around you, that the universe is waiting to give us those messages. Do you want to share a little about that? As I know it's later in the book, but given you just talked about it, let's dive right in.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll kind of talk about my mental model for how the world works, which will maybe make sense of how I think about these things. So in my mental model for how the world works, and like every model, it's useful, but probably ultimately wrong, or, you know, not quite right. My model for it is that, okay, I have this personality of Scott, this body, this mind, emotions, but there's something deeper, which is the real me, which I would call soul, right? You can call it whatever you want, but this essence that's beyond the measurement of some sort of scope, right? And my belief is that as soul, I'm this pure spark of energy, like we all are. And you might call it a pure spark of the divine or whatever your mental model is for that. And when we're tapped into that perspective, we're tapping into the thing, at the biggest level, right? And so that's where this alignment comes from. So when we quiet ourselves, like, look, sometimes it happens by grace, like a shout over the noise at a party, by luck, by happenstance. And sometimes we can go actively get it, you know? So actively getting it for me looks like when I quiet the rest of those senses, when I quiet the body, when I quiet the mind, when I quiet emotion, and on purpose try to see what this deeper part of me wants to say, that's where these things come from.
So it's the universe. It's you tapping into the energy of the entire universe.
Yeah, this bigger collective, I guess, you know, whatever you want to call it, the divine, that deeper part of me. This is where, who knows what it really is, right? But it's something that I would say is wiser than, you know, the personality of Scott, wiser than the mind, body, and emotion. So I think that, you know, this is where it gets into, for sure, into belief versus knowing. But the belief, my belief is that there's deeper wisdom, there's more meaning than, you know, meets the eye. And, you know, I think when we're really in tune, we become more of a co-creator with life. Like we move, I think there's this evolution that happens. We move from victim to player, or we move, in other words, that life is happening to us. Instead, we start moving or believing that life is happening for us. And then when we're really in tune, life happens through us. We actually become a co-creator with life. So that's what I'm trying to do.
And one of the things that you said in the book that I found very powerful was on that very subject, when you said every minute of every day we've been creating with our thoughts, our attitudes, our actions, usually we're asleep at the wheel while we're doing this, just reacting. We can take the wheel and create what we want. Can you unpack that one for us? Because that's what you were talking about right there, is the fact that we have that choice to not be a victim and to play the game.
Sure. But just think about maybe a day when we're perhaps not proud of our response to life. Or maybe you see someone else acting like this. They complain, whatever. They don't like what's going on. You could go big picture, it's we have war. You could go smaller picture, like it's raining outside and I don't like the rain. Or it's sunny outside and I don't like the sun. And we feel like we're a bit of a victim. We're put upon. It's like, oh, well, this probably means, and we go down this negative path of this bad thing's going to happen and that bad thing's happen. One of my favorite quotes right now is from Mark Twain. He said, you know, I lived through a lot of tragedies in my life, and some of them actually happened.
Yeah, we've used that one on the show a couple of times. It's a great one for realizing that so much of, you know, it's not what actually happens to us. It's how we think about or how we respond to what happens to us.
Exactly. And so this is what I mean by creating. When we're responding in a way that, oh, we've turned whatever information we're getting as a tragedy, then we're creating more tragedy. We've seen life as dangerous and negative, and that's going to create more danger and negativity. But when we shift the focus towards the light, then we create more light. And let's back up and unpack like how we got here. So this is how we evolved as a species, right? Most people know about the fight or flight systems in our body, you know, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Our fight or flight system is designed to keep us alive. Because in the old days, if you heard a noise in the woods, you assumed it was something dangerous, you know, and the body would instantly, you know, be flooded with stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol. And that kept us alive. And now we know that, okay, well, if we breathe deeply, or if we go fishing, or if we go for a walk, we can learn to regulate our body and, you know, do something more than just stay alive. We can move towards, you know, well-being. But our minds are the same way. Our minds have developed this negativity bias. In other words, we see all this information happening around us, and our minds tend to fixate on the most negative thing and say, that's what's important, because that's what kept us alive over millions and millions of years. By focusing on the most negative thing, it kept us alive. So think about if you work, think about the last time you had a performance review. You know, maybe there was 3 or 5 pages of all the amazing things you did well in the last time period, and 3 sentences about what you might improve for next time. You'll fixate on those 3 sentences. I call it pothole management, right? There can be 1,000 miles of perfect road, and if there's 1 pothole, this is where our mind goes. It goes to that pothole. Now, it doesn't mean that we don't pay attention to the pothole. We do. But we don't need to spend 99% of our time fixated on it. You know, the same is true of our relationships. Think about the person who's most close to you. If you have a spouse or partner or whatever, probably we spend, you know, a tremendous amount of time thinking about the 1 or 2 things that irritate us about what they're doing. And we lose track of the 99 things that they do great, that they're wonderful, that they're our person for. So it's all about shifting, right? When I say creating our world, if I'm thinking about my relationship and I'm fixated on the fact that my wife does X, then okay, my relationship is bad. And because I'm then causing it to be bad because of this mental energy I'm putting into it. Or if I put my attention on the 99 ways that we're perfect together, then I'm creating my future because I'm acting in a way that is dramatically different.
And a lot of that can often be attributed to the inner critic, or some might call it our monkey mind, just rolling around in there. Generally, you know, no guest on the show that I've had yet has said they know someone who has a positive monkey mind that says good things to them. So how do we learn, or how do you work with people to shut that off, to calm that down, so they can make that shift to seeing things from the light side instead of the dark side?
Sure. Yeah, the inner critic is the same voice, right? The pothole manager. I think it's first a recognition that this is going on, right? Awareness. Because awareness gives us choice. And so first, we become aware of it. Because most of the time, for a long time, and people sometimes their whole lives, they're not aware of it. And so they just continue to act in a certain way. But when we become aware of it, we can notice it. We can become an observer to our thoughts. Like, that's interesting. Look at me go. Look at me complain about the weather. Like, what? Is this helping? You know? Will it do any good if I run outside and scream at the sky? Like, it becomes kind of silly. So what we do is, just like the nervous response, we acknowledge it. We say, thank you. Thank you, inner critic. Or I like Arianne Huffington calls it the obnoxious roommate, which I appreciate. We can say, thank you. I appreciate you trying to keep me safe, but I've got it from here. So please, you know, go over there and be quiet. I don't need your opinion anymore. And now that we've got our own attention, we can realize, okay, one of my favorite questions is, what else is true? If I've been fixated on the pothole, I first acknowledge it. It's not that it's not real. The pothole exists. I want to fix it, of course. But what else is true? I had this experience one time so a number of years ago, I was coaching my son's Little League team, and I was leaving work in the middle of the day, and I had this big job. Like, people were expecting a lot of me, a lot of clients, a lot of employees trying to get my attention. And here I was leaving work at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday. And my inner talk track, my inner critic had gone dark, like really dark. And I'm in the car and now there's traffic. And I don't know, do you ever notice how nobody can drive when you're angry? Everybody becomes a terrible driver when you're angry.
Everyone but you. Everyone but you.
And so in my mind, I'm frustrated. I'm like, why am I the one who has to leave early to go get the field ready? Like, why can't anybody else help me? Why am I the one? And like all this poor me attitude. And it's just on and on and on, and then griping about traffic. And then I, in that moment, realized I had a choice. There was one choice, option A. I could continue with this complaining to myself for the next 35 or 40 minutes. I could arrive at baseball frustrated, angry. I get the field ready. When the other coaches arrive, I make some snide comment like, oh, I've already been here for half an hour by myself, or whatever. When the kids arrive, I'm grouchy with them, you know, and grouchy with the parents, grouchy with the other opposing coaches, grouchy with the umpire. And oh, we're going to have fun. or, so imagine like this beacon of darkness, essentially. Or I spend the next 35 or 40 minutes being grateful. I ask the question, what else is true? And then start to be grateful for those things. Okay, well, what else is true? What else? I mean, it starts with, look, I am grateful that I have a son. I always wanted a son. I'm grateful that my son likes to play baseball. Baseball was my thing when I was a kid. I love coaching. I love serving my community. I love, you know, so many things about it, on and on and on. And when the kids come, I'm going to high five them. We're going to go to the center field and we're going to sing the song that we made up together about SpongeBob and do silly things. You know, I'm going to gently tease the opposing coach and high five everybody that I see. And just imagine these two different scenarios and everybody that I impact. Now, in the car, nothing changes. Nothing changes about my external circumstances. Nothing changes about the way anybody else drives, but everything, and I mean everything, changes about life when I make that shift internally. And this is what I mean by we're creating our world. This is what I mean by we're changing the work. We're changing the world from the inside out. It starts with our own level of consciousness.
So when we shift, when we choose the consciousness that is the positive, that is the light, call it a karmic perspective or an energy perspective, what we radiate radiate out is what we're going to get back, because that's what we'll infect those around us with.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Maybe there's a different word when it's positive. Infect sounds like...
Yeah. What do we use when it's positive? What's the positive version of infection?
Yeah. I don't know. Everyone else glows. I don't know what it like. But yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. And let's go back in time. And I want to ask you about something that you said, and we've talked about this a little, and so you'll be able to dive into it. It was early in the book. It was actually in the introduction. You started with saying, I'll share with you my inner dialogue. For each of us, this is really where our development happens. It's usually not the actual events in life that we're learning from. It's in the shaping and changing and thrashing of the mind where our growth occurs.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. It's, you know, the Mark Twain quote nailed it. I think, you know, there's tons of studies that show that our happiness is not directly correlated to what's going on outside, right? So as an example, it turns out the act of being present is twice as big a factor in our happiness as the stuff in our lives. So it's what's going on in our minds is really when we describe to people how our day is going, it's usually a description of what's going on in our minds. And, you know, over time, we have more of a choice in how we respond to life. Usually we're reacting to life. Viktor Frankl had this quote about, and it's longer. If you have a chance to read the entire thing, do. It's from, well, anyway, he says that between stimulus and response, there's a space. And it's in that space where we choose our response. And it's in that response that lies our happiness. I may have gotten it a little bit wrong, but it's something like that. It's in the response that lies our happiness, not in the actual things that happen. And of course, the day-to-day stuff impact us, of course. A day when I lose my job is probably going to be more traumatic than a day when I get a promotion. But over the long haul, you know, most humans have kind of a steady state that they are on the happiness scale. Call it 1 to 10, right? Maybe someone's an 8, someone else is a 3. And on a day-to-day basis, they might go up and down like a sine wave or a spiky wave. But on average, they're one of those things. But the good news is, the research shows that you're not stuck there. We can move ourselves on this happiness scale. And a lot of it starts with what we're talking about. What we're talking about is first being aware of it and then making conscious choices to focus on, you know, the light rather than the dark.
And Scott, when were you able to first start developing some of these mindsets? I know you started spiritually exploring different avenues when you were young with your older brother. Was it that earlier, or was it later that you found meditation and mindfulness? And how has that evolved your level of, you might call it calmness or serenity, which then trickles into your life?
Sure. I think it probably started really early. And it started by osmosis. My father was a very positive man. He passed away 7 years ago. But his outlook on life was a lot of the same things that I'm talking about. You know, if something terrible happened, he's like, all right, here we go. We're going to get back up and tomorrow we're going to meet the day. Like whatever happened, he was the steady force. And just watching him, like I knew inside that this was the right way to act, that this was a good way to act. And as you mentioned, I discovered or started, I guess you'd say, a spiritual practice, a contemplative or meditative type practice when I was 13. But that didn't mean it was easy. That I had a, you know, tumultuous teenage years, and I would say that practice kept me alive, right? That practice allowed me to get through some really hard things. And so it's always been a part of me, I think. And then just as I've matured, it's become really a part of me. And then over time, you know, I became a manager and then a leader, or I, you know, got married and became a father. And all of those experiences shaped me in kind of moving from me to we, and moving from being a student to a teacher, or being in different roles where I had more responsibility. And I think anytime you start teaching something, you learn it at such a faster rate, right? It finally starts to click. These things that you thought you knew, when you start sharing them with your son, or you start sharing them with a colleague at work, it accelerates the, or deepens the learning of your own, in your own mind.
And it was while you were at work that you had another bit of another full body yes. And we'll talk about that concept later. But you were interviewing for another opportunity. You were doing some due diligence. And then you realized, wait, I'm already in the right spot. And it tied to the mindfulness and it expanded beyond that. And that's when you became the head of mindfulness and compassion. What did that look like for you, taking on a completely different role, non-operational, not what you'd been doing your whole career, and focused on what you're saying your mission is?
Yeah, that's right. So I'll back up a little bit. I'd had this practice outside of work since I was 13, but it's not something I ever talked about at work. I was, you might say, covering that part of my life. I wasn't being my full authentic self. And I got to LinkedIn almost 10 years ago now. And our CEO at the time, Jeff Weiner, was talking about his own meditation practice using Headspace. And that was eye-opening. He was talking about compassion in business. And that gave me kind of this air cover to say, well, let's bring this to work. You know, so I had a conversation with my friend who runs Global Wellness, and we were talking about meditation. We're talking about lots of different things. And we got really excited. Like I said that I would lead something. And he got really excited because here's this VP who's going to lead a wellness program. Amazing. Great. And I went back to my desk, all excited, and I did absolutely nothing about it for 3 or 4 months because I was terrified. You know, I had all this ego nonsense about, what are people going to think of me? Like, what is this going to do for my brand? Are people going to think I'm soft or, you know, whatever? All nonsense. And I finally led the first session and there was one guy there. And I'm sure that guy was just as terrified as I was, as I never saw him again. But the next week there were three and then there were five and then it was a regular thing. And then I got invited to bigger things. You know, the CFO would hold a finance offsite with 400 people. And invite me to kick it off with a meditation and things like that. And, you know, I raised my hand to be the executive sponsor of our mindfulness program, which we didn't have. And so myself and some other volunteers created one. And over the next few years as a volunteer, you know, created a really beautiful mindfulness program, one of the best in the world. And then, you know, it started out as my 2% job and was pretty soon my 10% job and then my 15%. And pretty soon, you know, it was clear that I needed to make a choice because I had a big day job, right? I had a team of 1,000 people in my day job. And so there was this moment in time where our CEO gave the commencement address at Wharton, which is a very, you know, buttoned down kind of powerful place. And he talked about compassion in business and leadership. Look, if you're going to be successful in life, successful in business, you have to be compassionate. And then the next day he's on TV and this is all the reporters want to talk about is compassion. And I was thinking, okay, it's time. Like it's time for me. I'd been in this ops role for 6 years. I was ready to do something else. And it's also time for LinkedIn because essentially our CEO just told our 15,000 employees that compassion was the most important thing that they could do. What does that even mean? And so I made a pitch to him and to our head of HR and with their great support, created this role, head of mindfulness and compassion programs. And it was very different, right? It was, I had to give up my VP title, which I felt very, you know, it was kind of part of my identity. I had to give up the idea that, well, I had to at least wrestle with the idea that my career, I'm air quoting career, as a businessman in that track of work was done. And now I was off doing this other thing. So on the one hand, it was terrifying. On the other hand, it's like, oh, this is what I was meant to do. This is what I've always wanted to do in the first place. And, you know, I focus on that part. And then massive, massive goodness has happened ever since then.
And so if you look at it, you talk about it in the book, and we've brought it up on the show a few times in different episodes, the Japanese concept of ikigai. And I don't know if I pronounced that right.
Yeah, ikigai.
The merger of certain aspects of what I do well, what the world needs, what I can get paid for, and what I love to do. And if you took the what I get paid for out, what would you really want to do? And ideally, that pay for it piece works. And for you, was that meeting right in the middle there for you, Scott?
You know, on the one hand, and this is not lost on me about this work, I had reached a point in my career where I felt comfortable in my own skin just because of my level of maturity. But I also felt comfortable in my own skin, partially because I'd reached a sense of financial security or financial freedom because I had done well in business. So that made it a lot easier versus if I was in a different set of circumstances. So it made it a lot easier to take this risk, air quoting risk. It wasn't that big of a risk because financially I was fine. But it was certainly part of the equation. right? I was certainly leaving something on the table, but the desire of getting to do the center of the bullseye of my ikigai was way more important to me.
And you raise an interesting point, because I know I was in a similar spot in my career and never talked about mental health, never talked about mindfulness or meditation. And it was only at the start of COVID or a few months into COVID where I saw that the isolation people were experiencing was amplifying their mental health challenges, that I thought, if there's ever a time that I should be willing to talk about the challenges I felt with, that I should be willing to talk about mindfulness, it's now, so that other people have an eye that they're not alone. And I do recognize, though, that the privilege of being where I was in the company as the CFO and having reached a certain level of financial freedom, I didn't really have to worry about career implications that some younger colleagues might. And you spoke a little bit about that. Do you think that's something that is shifting as we raise more awareness? Or is that challenge still there for people in the workplace? And how can we overcome that with time?
Sure. Well, I'll think about it like this. So for pioneers, so let's say that having a head of mindfulness is kind of a pioneering thing, right? There's not that many of us out there in the industry. For the pioneers, it's got to be the right situation, right? You have to know somebody, you have to be a certain level or a certain set of expertise, but that's laying the groundwork for it to be more natural, so that 10 years from now or 20 years from now or 50 years from now, there are more jobs generally, and they're more available for all levels of, you know, for all levels. And I think that's generally true of these things that are out at the edges of our shaping things, right? Sometimes it happens by, well, anyway, that's just kind of how it works sometimes. Now, this other thing about, you know, is this true of all industries or all careers, right? If you think about, well, what about me? Wherever you are in your career, what do I do with this whole ikigai thing? Because I can't quit my job and totally change careers. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. If you think about these four circles, what I love to do, what I'm good at, what someone will pay me for, and what the world needs, probably, not for everybody, but probably even within your current job, you can shape your work to be more of those things, right? You can shape your work to be more of what you love. So as an example, you know, as I was kind of coming up in middle management, one of the things I asked myself is, I really loved people development. And I thought, well, maybe I'll quit my job and go be an executive coach, you know, 15 years ago. And at the end of the day, I realized I actually didn't want to quit my job and go be an executive coach after I kind of dabbled in it. But what I did want to do is increase the amount of coaching I did within my daily role, right? So I shifted my focus, you know, a little bit away from some things and more into the people development. And that was a way I was able to shift. Now, maybe you have that luxury, maybe you don't, but just think about that as, even from where I stand, can I use that ikigai thing as a filter for decisions I make about my role? And usually the answer is yes.
And so if you think about it, what you're also doing there is you're using what we talked about earlier with the "and what else is true," right? So if I look at my job, there's a lot of accounting. I don't like accounting, but I do like coaching people, and it's a big team, and I'm able to help those people grow. To your point, right? It's a coaching element in the job. And if I focus on that because it's true, then I can ignore or minimize the impact or the response of the other thing that is true, but it doesn't have to be the only thing that's true.
It's kind of a logical pass down because we have choice, right? If somebody says, well, I don't really like my job, I have all this accounting stuff that I do, I'm like, quit. Oh, I can't quit. Yes, you can. You can walk into your boss's office right now or virtually say, I quit. You can. It's a choice. Now, the ramifications, the repercussions are significant, but it's still a choice. And so then the next thing is like, well, okay, well, I can't quit because I need the money to feed my family. It's like, all right. So you're choosing to feed your family, which is very different than saying, I don't have a choice, right? It's a subtle shift, but the subtle shift is really, really important in how we feel about our jobs and how we feel about our lives, right? The same thing is true with our relationships. I'm unhappy. Okay, well, break up. I can't. It's not that you can't, it's you're not willing to. And so it's where we put our attention. So then it's like, okay, well, I'm staying. I'm choosing to be in this relationship. So if I'm choosing this, if I'm choosing this job, if I'm choosing this life from that perspective, then how can I make it the best it can be? Because why would I choose it and be terrible at it? Why would I choose it and sabotage myself? And so it's moving from this victim, this life is happening to me, to life is happening for me, and realizing that I'm responsible. I'm in the driver's seat. I can choose so many things, and almost all of it is happening inside my mind.
And part of the importance of that, because this is something we talk about with a lot of people, when someone says, I need to, or I have to, or I ought to, or I must, I often try to get them to reframe that to I choose to, which is what you're saying, because there's a power in the words that we use with ourselves. When we use must or need or want, it's almost like we're being a dictator to ourselves, Scott. Even if it's ourselves, no one likes being dictated to, right? So why is it, you also talk about the importance of the words, like we just said, but the labels and reframing. Can you dive a little into that? And you've talked a little bit about the reframing from the dark to the light, but how it all ties together there?
Sure. Yeah, the reframing is just so powerful because I think it shapes our whole existence. You know, the words we choose, the level of responsibility that we take, all of it is moving from us being a victim to us taking responsibility. And it's just like, it's the difference between being a renter or an owner, right? The level of care, if you were in college or whatever, had a rental property and maybe didn't really care about it, or you got your first place that was really yours and how well you took care of it. Or for me, the difference between moving from an individual contributor to being a manager was incredibly powerful because all of a sudden I felt responsible for the company. I felt like, oh, it's my company. Well, it was my company as an individual contributor too, but I just didn't feel that same level of responsibility. But the thing is, when we move to that responsible life, it changes in that same way. It's like, oh, this is my life. I'm in charge. And so it's such an incredible starting point to then reframe every one of these experiences. Like, I choose to do this. And I choose. There's incredible, and we talk about the power of freedom, right? Freedom is one of the most powerful human conditions. Well, this is a way to give yourself freedom. And nothing about the outer situation might change in that moment. But the mere shift to say, I'm free, is incredibly powerful.
I love that one. I want to take you in a different direction and do a pivot to when you were younger, because there's something that happened or a realization you had as you got a little bit older. And it really resonated with me because it's a similar rationale for what's driven me in my life. So you, when you were young, decided that you were going to beat your siblings at everything they were good at. You were going to dominate.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And your rationale was you wanted dad to notice you, right? To give you a hug. And, you know, that really ties to the other quote we use a lot is Carl Jung, until we make the unconscious conscious, we will forever be led by it and call it fate. So when did you realize that what was driving you so ambitiously? Because you said at the beginning, we're going to talk about ambition and pairing it with compassion. When did you realize that that was what was driving you? Was wanting dad's attention?
I think I was aware of it in the moment, you know, as a 15-year-old, and it was the dark and the light doing battle inside, right? So I'm the youngest of five. My siblings are all quite a bit older than me. They're all very successful at what they do, and in different things. You know, from music to art to academics to whatever, sports. And yeah, I decided, you know, I was going to be better at each of them in their specialty. And so I was just kind of wired in this competitive way. You know, I wanted to win, and I wanted to win in a way that all of their trophies would be replaced by mine. You know, all the pictures on the wall would be replaced by mine. And I was also aware in that moment that that wasn't quite right, but it's still like I had a hunger for it. And, you know, what I would say is that's a very powerful success strategy And it's a terrible, terrible, terrible strategy for happiness, right? Because comparison is a terrible strategy for happiness. Comparison is the thief of joy. And so what I found over time with each win, with each triumph, with each promotion, is that there was nothing different on the other side. You know, it's not like I ran the race and crossed the red ribbon and everything was different. It was exactly the same, just with one more trophy in the case. And so what I realized over time, it's like, oh, it's this movement from me to we, this movement from thinking only about myself and my own achievements to thinking about service, to serving the whole. So instead of how can I continue to enhance my talents so that I can be more successful, I started shifting to how can I enhance my talents and my skill set so that I can serve. And it's in that service, it's in the combination of those, like expressing myself and the service, where I, for all of us, I think is where true joy lies.
And when would you say in your career you had that realization, Scott?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was a slow burn, a slow burn of sort of realizing that's probably the answer, but still wanting the other thing. You know, like it's kind of like that, you know, you ever buy a lottery ticket and then you spend 3 or 4 days fantasizing about what you would do with whatever it is, $400 million? You know, on the one hand, you know, like the studies are all out there, you know that that $400 million is not going to make you any happier. Like statistics show. It's not going to make you any happier, but you still want it. It's like, I'll be the one. I'll try it. I'll be willing to, you know, I'll be willing to try that.
Yeah, it might not make me happier, but it's a lot easier to do the inner work that will make me happy when I don't have to worry about money. That's what we like to tell ourselves, right?
Exactly. That's what we tell ourselves. So in the same way, I probably knew all these things from the beginning, but it's like, let me just try it. I don't quite really... So look, I think there's a difference between information and knowledge and wisdom. So probably I had all this information when I was 16, right? Probably I had heard all these things from my dad or read it in books, information. And then knowledge is you start to put it into practice. Like you start to get, you know, you start to have lessons where the information is relevant to you. And you're like, okay, now it's knowledge. Like I kind of understand it. And then at some point it turns into wisdom, which is like this deep, like, I know it in my bones. I don't need to try any more times. Like, I already know the answer. And so for me, it's this probably maybe not quite 100% of wisdom yet, but we're getting a lot closer.
And so as you, when we have enough space and we have the time, which is something you write about, then we are able to see the lessons while we're living them. How do we evolve or shift so that we can appreciate those lessons while they're happening to us?
I think this is one of the challenges. For again, awareness. Awareness gives us choice. So probably all of us have some experience where we went through something that was hard 10 years ago or sometime in our past. And now with the benefit of time, with 10 years or 20 years or more, we can say, oh, that experience was really good for me. Actually, that taught me a lot, right? In my own experience, you know, at one point I was laid off 3 times in 3.5 years. I lost my job 3 times in 3.5 years. And in that moment, if you'd asked me if I was grateful for that, it was hard to find the joy in all of that happening. But 15 years later, I can say that was the best thing that ever happened to my career because it changed the trajectory of my career. I had to go get these different skills and have all these different experiences and wander around in the desert. But all of that led to this amazing thing, which is true. And I'm sure all of us have this experience, something that was hard, but now with the benefit of time, we realize it was good for us. Now, the hard part is, first of all, we have to be able to admit this to ourselves. That hard thing was good for us. Then, black belt level gratitude is, when I'm going through something hard right now, like right now, and I'm in the moment of this hard thing, can I really ask myself, okay, well, what else is true? What can I be grateful for right now? Can I start to, maybe I don't have all the answers because it's not clear to me yet, but what if I approach this knowing, like this deep knowing that this is right, this is what is supposed to happen, this is going to be good for me. I may not see the full thing right now, but I know that it's true. And for me, this is probably a belief, right? Just a belief in how the world works. But my belief is that if we operate in this way, if we have this belief that life is happening for me, then my whole life starts to reorient around that thing. I start to be a co-creator. I start to look at and be curious about, like, what is this mess that I'm going through? Like, what is this teaching me? Where before I might just be resistant, you know, like dragging a cat into the shower. The cat is like, just like scrambling to get out of it. That's how I might approach it before. And so for all of us, starts with this recognition and this gentle movement to what else is true? What's the good in this? How can I see the positive outcome? How can I be a co-creator instead of a resistor?
So we're looking at the fact that life is happening for me. And it's almost the mindset, if you will, that everything that happens, happens for the best possible reason. And just trying to understand for yourself, well, what is that reason? Why did this happen? How could this be good? And you give the example of the sage in the older person in the village when the young guy goes to war, which is a favorite story, is, you know, as things happen, he always says, we'll see, we'll see. And because in the fullness of time, we will see whether it was good or bad. And the longer we go, the more good we see.
That's right. And what I would say is, this is my belief system about how the world works. You know, I believe that we're soul, we're here to learn how to be responsible for ourselves, how to give and receive the divine. And even if you don't believe any of that, even if you have a completely opposite, you know, worldview on how the world works, this, what we're talking about, is still a powerful mental strategy to get through life, right? To get curious about life, to say, what is the good? How does this work? Even if you don't believe in anything else, it's still an incredibly powerful way to live.
It's one of those ones that even if you're wrong, it's still probably a more enjoyable and happier way to live than if you believe the opposite.
That's right. That's what I think. Like, nobody knows for sure, so I'm going to go with the thing that makes me the most happy. And if I'm wrong, I won't know any different because it'll just all go black. Like, who cares?
True.
Nobody will be there to go, hey, I told you so. Who cares?
It's largely the way I view it as well, is none of us know what's on the other side. But as long as we're enjoying it while we're here, it'll be whatever the end result is, will be better while we're here. So something you talked about in there was you brought up gratitude. And in your book, you talk about gratitude being a superpower. Why is it such a superpower if we let it be? Because a lot of us don't let it be. And how can people improve their gratitude practice? For example, you talked about micro-compassion. What else is there, journaling, that you throw at people to say, hey, let's get some gratitude into your life?
Well, let's talk about why it's powerful, right? We talked about this negativity bias that we have. We've evolved this way to focus on the negative because that kept us alive. And look, inertia has carried us here for however many years we are old, but also from the thousands and millions of years of evolution before then. Inertia has carried us here. So unless we do something, then something different from that inertia, we will continue to get the same thing. And so the shifting away from I focus on the most negative thing that kept me alive to I'm going to focus on more positive things because that's going to make me more happy. That's where it starts, right? This idea of shifting. So this is the why. Now, the how, let me share some statistics. They did a couple studies on gratitude about people who kept a gratitude journal. And there's different ways to do this, but it's essentially, you know, every night or most nights or days, write down something you're grateful for. People who kept a gratitude journal were measurably more optimistic, were measurably less stressed, and were measurably more happy, right? Who doesn't want those three things, right? If I said I had a pill that would make you feel less physical stress, would make you more optimistic and more happy, like, would you pay to take that pill? Yeah, of course. Would you pay 10% of your net worth to have 10% more happy? I mean, I don't know. So first of all, just think about that, right? In another study, they did the same type of deal. People kept gratitude journals. And the people who kept gratitude journal, it acted like a supercharger to all of their other positive health habits. In other words, they were more likely to stick to their diets. They were more likely to stick to their exercise plans. They were more likely to stick to the other good things that they wanted in their life. So gratitude itself is like this reorientation. away from the dark, closed, small part of us into this bigger, broader, open, more, you know, more alive part of us. It's incredibly powerful. But let's talk about how to put it to use. You know, one of my favorite quotes right now is from James Clear, wrote Atomic Habits. And one of the two summaries from Atomic Habits is the following. He says, look, our lives do not rise to the level of our goals. They fall to the level of our systems. Meaning, we have these great intentions, but unless we put a system in place, nothing's going to change, right? It's like New Year's resolutions. We might have this idea that we're going to do XYZ differently this year, but unless we put a system around it, nothing changes. Okay, so how do I make this work? All right, let's say at work, you want to have more gratitude for people around you. How do you do anything at work? Like for me, I use my calendar. So maybe I'm going to schedule once a month or once a week on a Friday afternoon at noon or 2 o'clock, a little gratitude time. And during that time, I'm going to set a goal of what to do. Maybe it's to text or call somebody and just share something that I'm grateful for about them. Maybe it's a handwritten note, anything, but create the system to put in place. You know, it could be one of the things that I love to do is I love birthdays, right? So I like to keep everybody's birthday. I have it on the calendar. I like to send them a note on their birthday. Yeah. If it's at home, maybe around the dinner table, you start a tradition or continue a tradition of when we sit down around a meal, we're going to create some space. What are you grateful for? And you kind of have to mix it up, right? If you make it the same every time from your 8-year-old, you're going to get, I'm grateful for recess. So maybe you mix it up and make it no repeats. You can never repeat anything you say. And so there's lots of these ways, but put a system in place and it'll make it alive.
Oh, it's beautiful. Thank you for that. The something that I've enjoyed picking up is your level of curiosity and how you explore all of these areas. And part of that, you have a passion for IQ tests, personality tests, and one of them in particular, the Enneagram, finding out you were a type 7. So part of what I'm wondering, why such a fascination for personality tests? And you do talk about the importance of knowing ourselves. So a double in there, why the personality test is a way to do it, and why is it so important that we know ourselves?
I think that, you know, I think at the root of it, we have this deep-seated need, the need to be seen, the need to be recognized, the need to be loved. This is one of our deepest-seated needs, and a lot of our actions stem from that. You know, as a kid, I had all these questions like, who am I? And I was fascinated, you know, thinking about all the different belief systems and what the afterlife was and why I was here on the planet. Who am I? Why am I? And so I was fascinated to learn, fascinated to take any of these tests, Myers-Briggs and AVA and DISC and then the Enneagram and 15 others in between. And each one kind of added to this tapestry that's, you know, about my favorite topic, me. And I think the root of it is just trying to understand. So I don't know exactly why, but I think it starts with this. When we understand who we are and deeply know ourselves, then we start to, maybe this doesn't go in order, but for me, this was the order. Then we start to really get curious about other people too, to realize that other people have these stories, other people have these differences. And I'm just fascinated by the human condition, right? About how we're all different in our own ways, but also similar in our own ways. And that was kind of one of the interesting things about the Enneagram. You know, I'd taken all these other tests, and they often are a description of how we show up in the world, like how other people experience us. But for me, the Enneagram was why. Why we show up in the world that way. What our inner motivations are. And I don't know. I just think it's fascinating.
And so you were a type 7. Do you remember what your next two highest numbers were?
Don't offhand, you know, remember the trifecta.
Yeah.
Well, I'm 3. I'm sure, actually, I know that 3 is one of the other ones that's very close, the achiever. And the third one, I'm not sure about.
Yeah, I thought there might be an 8 in there for you. We'll see.
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
Yeah, anyway, no. But I'll look.
Yeah, a couple of guests have mentioned the Enneagram, and I have taken it, but I've never done a deep dive into what it means and how it ticks. So it feels like something I have to dig deeper into, Scott.
Yeah, and if you do dig deeper, well, one of the things that was really helpful for me is I took it at work, And you end up with this 35-page report, and my wife was reading it, and she's like, I want to take it too. And so she took it too. And the combination of we both got to read each other's things was super powerful for our relationship. Because then you start to like, you see that when the other person is acting a certain way, it doesn't have anything to do with me. This is just how they're programmed. This is just who they are. This is how they're wired. And we can start to like let go of some of the reaction I have to some of the things she does. It's like, that's not about me at all. This is just who she is in the world and vice versa.
And that's a good point, because when you, so there's a power right there. That's a superpower, is when you do that with your partner, you do that with your children. It doesn't excuse how you behave with each other necessarily, depending on how you behave with each other, but it does give an awareness to your statement, what else is true, right? And so often someone will be having a conversation with their partner and they ask something simple like, hey, could you clean that up? And in your head, you hear, you're a lazy slob. And that's the inner critic just firing negativity at you. But to your point, when you know why, how they're wired, how orderliness is so important to them versus you, they're really just asking, hey, can you help me out and align with how I'm wired, which is for a clean house? That's all I want.
That's right.
Okay. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Awareness, right? All of these things are about awareness, and that awareness gives us choice. We can respond versus react.
So if we go back to earlier in your life when you had one of your first full body yeses, your friend Ben asked you a question, which was, what does your true self want? And in responding to that question from him, you had what you refer to as a full body yes. So I'm wondering if you can share for the audience, what does that experience look like? How does it feel in our body, and how do we know, yes, I've got a full body yes here? And then how do we tap into that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the full body yes, it happens all the time. So it happens, think about things that are low stakes. Like you wake up in the morning, what am I going to have for breakfast? Like, oh, I think I'll have whatever, yogurt and fruit, or I'm going to have eggs and bacon, whatever it is. Like you don't have any, usually, internal stress about it. You just decide and you go have it. That's essentially the full body yes. Like when all of your systems are aligned, your mind, your body, your emotions, and something deeper. Now it's more powerful when it's something that has been hard or we've been struggling with. Should I leave this job that I'm struggling with? Should I take another job? Should I leave this marriage? Should I join or leave this relationship? Should I, you know, all of these questions we have about life, those are the ones we struggle with. And sometimes you've probably had this experience where the mind is racing. The mind is like, yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. And the gut is like, I think that we should go A. And the mind says, no, that sounds dangerous. We're doing B. And you feel torn. And then sometimes what happens, at least for me, is that by chance or by grace or by whatever, I'll just, boom, like everything comes into alignment. You know, so as an example, when I was interviewing 9 or 10 years ago for the job at LinkedIn, on paper, in other words, my mind, on paper, the job didn't look that great. Like I was like, why would I want to do this job? I haven't done the job I'm in. I love my boss. I love everything about it. And so I'm interviewing, you know, kind of like I got this gut feel I should interview, but my mind is like, why are we doing this? This makes no sense. And then I woke up in the middle of the night at 1:30 in the middle of the kind of this interviewing season. And I just knew I have this thing called the full body yes. It's like, I'm supposed to do this job. Like I have no idea why, but I know I'm supposed to do it. And for me, that was it. It was over. Like the mind was quiet after that. Of course, I still went through the interview process, but everything was like, I don't know why, but I'm supposed to do it. It was so strong. And I've had that in different moments throughout my life. And I feel very fortunate to have that. So I think sometimes it happens like that, where it just overcomes us by chance, you might say. But also, I think we can cultivate a relationship with life, with ourselves, where we give ourselves more of a chance to tap into that deeper part of us, right? If you go back to my belief system, I believe that I'm soul and I'm wearing this personality of Scott, which is the body, the mind, emotions. And if I can quiet that part, if I can quiet the body, the mind, and emotions and listen to this deeper voice, that's when the goodness happens.
So if I'm, and we often talk about this for creativity as well, if I'm having a regular meditation practice and I'm just quieting the noise, then there's room for creativity or for a deeper answer to come into our mind.
And some people, you know, some people have probably had the experience where they've had a great idea in the shower, or they've had a great idea while they're out for a walk or fishing or whatever. And this is partly what's happening. The mind is being quieted, the body is being settled, and then it allows for something else to happen. So there's the normal allowing, and then I think there's the going and getting, right? And the going and getting is one step further. And this is, again, on my belief system, but that's about like, how do I access soul directly? So the quieting of the mind is, it for me, passive. But then there's this active state of activating the imagination, which I think comes from a different place than the mind. So activating the imagination or activating soul is a very conscious practice that I go beyond, what I would say, beyond meditation.
And what are some ways or prompts that you may facilitate that going and getting? And you had the example of when you were doing the interview for the role and you had two great candidates, 50-50, and you finally sort of just said, hey, I'm going to have a meditation. And while I'm meditating, I'm going to go and get it. I'm going to say, if I see a vision of this, it's going to be this person. If I see a vision of that, it's going to be that person. And the next day, you had that vision.
Yeah, I think so. Part of it is a belief in this. In a belief in that the world works like that. So in this case, it's like I intentionally ask the divine. I'm having a conscious conversation with the divine saying, I'm trying to work with you here. Like, what do you want to have happen? If it's person A, I'm going to see A. If it's person B, I'm going to see B. And then the next day I saw B. You know, in this case, it was an orange rhinoceros, which is on the cover of the book. But here's the thing. I think that if you believe that life works that way, then it works that way. And if you believe that life doesn't work that way, then it won't work that way. Like I retold this my big experience to someone else and they're like, wow, what a coincidence. What a coincidence that you saw an orange rhinoceros after you asked for one. And I'm like, okay, I can't, I can't talk. I mean, what, don't you understand what I'm saying? It's not a coincidence.
I tapped into the energy of the universe. Don't you? And you do. You know, it's that rare moment when you're in meditation that you actually feel that. And there's different ways to do it, but there's that moment where you just feel like, wait a second, I'm not alone. I'm attached to me, you, everyone. We're energy that's attached to each other. And it's an interesting feeling. And then it goes away and, I got to get back there. Got to get back there. And we spend the rest of our time doing it. Going back to ambition and career, something that you said, and I think you could write a phenomenal tweet off this one, Scott, is that 15 years from now, the jobs we're completely consumed by will be reduced to three bullets on a resume. Our relationships, the connections with our family, our colleagues, our neighbors, those will be with us forever. Can you tell us more on that one?
Yeah. I mean, that's it, right? So we spend our lives consumed by what we think is important. And what we think is important are these careers. And the careers are important because of survival, right? A lot of what happens to us is based on how we evolved. Okay, well, let's play that out. In evolutionary ways, having more resources kept us alive, right? And also a sense of, you know, likability kept us alive in the savannah. Right? With more resources we had, the more likable we were, the more chances of our survival. So we've played that into our modern lives of, okay, I really need to be the best. And if I'm the best, then I'm going to have more resources, right? If I get promoted more, or I make more money, I'm going to have more resources, then I'm safe. And if I have more status and I'm more likable, and I have more likes on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok, then I'm safe. Now, this is not, we're usually not conscious of it. We're not saying it in the same language. But that's what's going on. We're trying to stay alive. But beyond that is something way more powerful. Oh, so we get fixated on our career, you know, and we're climbing this mountain of career because we miss the point that it's not the same as happiness. We think that, okay, with each promotion, it increases our happiness. And, you know, the truth is the further we go, the more that's not true. It may, or I should say the correlation is less. It may or may not be true. it may or may not be true. But what is true, I think, is that when it really comes down to it, what's most important in our lives? Well, this has been front and center during the last 2 years of the pandemic. If you ask pretty much everybody in the last 2 years, if they could boil down, okay, what's really important to you? It's one of two things. It's their health and it's their relationships. Because if you don't have those two things, you realize how empty it is, right? If you're the CEO of a company or three companies, but you don't have any friends and you're sick, like, would anybody take that trade? Probably not, right? And so it's realizing it early. And so we started talking about how do you balance ambition with inner peace? And there's two stories from the spiritual traditions that haunted me for 30 years, which I think I finally have some understanding of. The first story is something like this. The teacher and the student are together, and there's some sort of baptismal event, right? And the teacher dunks the student underwater. Okay, that was going to happen. But then continues to hold him there and hold him there and hold him there until the student is struggling, like he's about to expire. And at the last moment possible, whisks him up in the air, and you have this, you know, this precious breath. And then later, when everything's calmed down, the teacher says, look, when you want truth as much as you wanted air in that moment, you'll find it. Okay? That's story number one. This is about desire, ambition, wanting, doing. In story number two, teacher's with the student, and the teacher, after a long discourse, says, you know, when you finally give up, when you finally let go of your desperate search for truth, you'll find it. And I thought, how can these two things exist in the same universe? Like, how do you have both? You can't have both. Like, surely it's like an immovable object and an irresistible force that can't exist in the same universe. But here's my understanding of it now. The first one is about doing, right? It's about expressing who we are. And it's, for me, it's about being the best Scott that I can be, right? Because this is soul. Soul is creative by nature. It wants to express itself. It wants to move around in the world. And the second one is about letting go. The second one is about being, not doing, but being, right? They are the same two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, we're striving and we're creating and we're manifesting and we're co-creating. And on the other hand, we're letting go. There's no way that we can control the result. So we know that and we let go of whatever the result is, knowing that as long as if we keep doing in a certain way, then it doesn't matter what happens.
I often refer to it either as active patience or persistent patience. A lot of people hear patience and they think, okay, well, I'll just wait for that job to come, or I'll just wait to get rich. What the one teacher is saying is, no, you have to do the work. What the other teacher is saying is, you just have to be patient on the results. You can't worry about when it's going to come. Do the work, and it's going to come at some point. I love that.
Or it may not.
Just keep doing the work.
But either way is okay.
Yeah, keep sitting, and maybe eventually it'll come. Maybe it won't.
Yeah. There's a practice that the Tibetan monks do that I love. They make these sand mandalas. Have you seen these?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
If you're a listener and you don't know what I'm talking about, go Google, do a search on sand mandala. And they're essentially these beautiful, intricate, and sometimes massive designs on the floor or on a giant table. And first, one of the monks, you know, makes the outline of this design. And then they spend the next amount of time. It could be hours. Sometimes it's days. Sometimes it's months creating one of these, depending on how big it is. And they're essentially drawing with colored sand, right? They're dropping individual grains of colored sand into these little things. Think about the concentration required. This is desire, right? This is creation. This is doing. You're completely focused on your goal. You're doing 100% of what you can do. You're filling in the orange without getting in the blue. You're not sneezing. You're completely focused. Okay. And then at the end of the month of creating this thing, what do you think they do? Okay. Well, if it's me, I'm going to shellac it on top. I'm going to put it on a poster. I'm going to take selfies with it, put it on Instagram, get a bazillion likes. And then reflect in how awesome I am. That's not what happens. They sweep it up. They sweep it up into a pile. They put it into some jars. They go find a body of water and they release it. They let it go. And to me, this perfectly describes this dance of striving and then letting go. Because some people think that the striving and then letting go is soft. Like, oh, if I don't have a goal, like if I let go of the result, how can I be? Well, this is how. You don't let go of what you're doing. You put extraordinary care and responsibility into the doing as much as you possibly can. And then you let go of the result because you have no control over the result.
I love that. Just the thought of it. I know it would be so hard to do. So there would definitely be lessons learned from that one, Scott. Like you, I like a fair amount of achievement. So the idea of getting there and then just letting it go. Wow. So one of the last questions I wanted to ask you, because I thought it was super important, especially with what we're seeing in the world right now, right this minute, is if we are hardwired only to feel compassion for people who are like us. And I was blown away when I read that MRI study you talked about. I had never, you know, a lot of things you're like, oh, I'd never heard that one, Scott. It blew me away. How can we change that hardwiring?
Yeah. So the study I'm referring to is they put people in an MRI machine and showed them images of essentially other people in pain. And at first, they just showed a picture of essentially they showed somebody getting stabbed with a needle in the sensitive part in your hand, like between the thumb and the finger. And what happens is your pain receptors, the part of your brain lights up. That was in A, right? Everybody sees another person in pain and our pain receptor lights up. But then they put these labels on hands, and the labels were Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Jewish, atheist, Scientologist, and then tried it again. And essentially, if you saw a picture of someone from your in-group in pain, you would light up, your pain matrix would line up. But if you saw someone from your out-group in pain, it wouldn't. You'd essentially have a flat line. So I'm interpreting this as essentially we are programmed to feel compassion for people who are in our in-group, who are in our tribe, in our team. And it doesn't matter so much about religions as whoever you identify with. So your question is, how do we expand that circle? How do you have compassion for someone, in fact, who's the exact opposite? So if you think of a war situation, country A is at war with country B, and you see bad things happening to people on your side of things, how do you have compassion for the other side? This is the black belt level, right? This is like ninth degree black belt level. Well, it starts with seeing, it's essentially the same thing as the pothole. What else is true? I'm fixated on the pothole, but I ask, what else is true? What else is true? That 19-year-old kid with the AK, he has a family too. What else is true? He just wants to live his life. He is just trying to do the best he can. He's been happy. He's been sad. I start to see myself in him or her or them. To see that the truth is 97% of us, 97% about our attributes are the same. But we tend to focus on the 3% that are different. So here's the thing. If I can see that other person, let me go back one. If I can see myself as soul with this idea that this personality of Scott, the body, mind, and spirit is just here for soul to get around and learn a bunch of lessons from, that means that I should be able to start seeing this other guy, this other woman, this other person as soul too, and realize that whatever they're going through, it's just a play. They're here to learn a set of lessons. And together, we're in this dance together. And I don't have to agree with them. I don't have to put up with it. But I can still send them my unconditional love. I can still send them my unconditional love and still fight for my homeland. This is where it gets really, really interesting to put all of the extremes and black and whites and things. I can hold it all. I can be that person who defends to the end of my life, while still having unconditional love for the person on the other side of it.
And so, Scott, if we're able to do meta practice, loving compassion, then we're able to, it's hard to not like someone when you're wishing them well, when you're doing acts of service for them, when you're picturing them in your mind and you're wishing them love and health and happiness. It's hard to then say, we should do atrocities to those people.
Exactly. So for me, this is the root. This is why I'm focusing my life on compassion, because I can open a news browser on any given day and see the terrible things in the world. And it's not just this week. It wasn't just a year ago. It's been like this forever, right? Always and forever, and probably always and forever will be. And I think, okay, well, I could dedicate my life or I could quit my job and I could go try to fix one of these problems. Pick a problem, you know, whether it's the environment or racial or social injustice or war or the political system or the education, pick one, any of them. And if we focus on consciousness, right? If we focus on compassion, if we all raise our own self-compassion, compassion for others, raise our own consciousness, then I believe that every one of those situations is improved. Every one of them.
Wow. That's a great spot to end our conversation. But one of the things I want to do is make sure, is there anything we missed in that wide-ranging conversation that you want to get across to people, Scott?
Wow. I think we'll leave it there. So if I sum it up, our most important task is our own development, right? It's our own development for the reasons we just talked about. Because as we develop ourselves, as we raise our own consciousness, as we do the work, then we start to see the world very differently. We start to see others in a very different way and realize they're just like us. You know, a little bit different context, a little bit different personality, but mostly we're the same. And when we come at the world from that perspective, everything changes. So the world needs more of you being at your very best.
It's beautiful. And where can people find you, Scott?
Yeah, you can find me at my website, scottshute.com. If you're interested in my book, it's called The Full Body Yes. In fact, if you sign up for my newsletter at scottshute.com, you'll get the first two chapters, including the chapter we talked about with the orange rhino. You can find out about the secret of the orange rhino. If you want to meditate with me, you can find me on Insight Timer. I'm live there every couple weeks. And I have a class or two on Insight Timer. And then just generally, you can follow me on LinkedIn. That's the social platform I use the most.
Okay. We'll have all that in the show notes and I will check you out on Insight Timer. One of the best apps that you can have on your iPhone or Android phone. It has a free version and a premium version, so check it out. Big fan of that one. Scott, thank you for being on The Pursuit of Learning today. I really enjoyed reading The Full Body Yes and having a conversation with you.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on The Pursuit of Learning. Make sure to hit the subscribe button and head over to our website, thepursuitoflearning.com, where you will find our show notes, transcripts, and more. If you like what you see, sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, your host in learning, Clint Murphy.